This afternoon is case number 68814, DeVos versus State. We have Mr. Cooper from the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and we have Mr. Figler, defense attorney, for the appellant. Well, first of all, the court welcomes Mr. Figler and Mr. Cooper to the Supreme Court of Nevada. Thank you for coming up from Clark County, both of you. And we're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, my name is David Figler. I represent Chris DeVos, who was convicted of second-degree murder of his brother, Charles Burnett, despite neither the state nor the defense advocating that verdict. Charles, also known as Bobby, sustained a single wound to his neck seconds after he charged and tackled my client, Chris DeVos, out the front door of their apartment, leading to the parties going down into the dirt outside of the apartment. Unfortunately, a wound was sustained by Avi, and that wound led to an imbalance in blood pressure that resulted in his death 3 days later. The theory of defense centered on self-defense, but it also left open the possibility of voluntary manslaughter, given that there was only a brief interval between the time of the first assault on my client, which resulted in substantial and painful bodily harm, and the single injury to the decedent, which he sustained on his neck. Now, before I proceed, there are undisputed facts that are quite instructive with regard to the analysis of this case and what occurred with regard to the ultimate verdict. Those undisputed facts are the following. One, that Chris DeVos sustained a serious, painful, and highly provoking physical injury when his jaw was broken at the hands of his brother, Otto. The initial injury happened in DeVos' own home where he lived. The interim period between the injury and his return to his own home consisted of him tending to his injury, moaning, looking at it at a mirror, and then returning to his home. Also undisputed is that the jury rejected the notion that he was deliberating his actions during that short interval between the painful injury and his return home.
What was that interval? Did he have to drive? Did he run to his girlfriend's house or Miss Seabrook's house? What de minimis interval are we talking about?
So in the light most favorable to the state, it would be as only 5 minutes. Ms. Seabrook was his ex-girlfriend, and it was made very clear from the record that she did not want him to be there or stay there because she had a new person in her life and that he was very jealous. So the testimony of Mr. Thomas, the other brother who was living in the apartment, established that at about 5 minutes, and that was the theory that the state had proceeded on. The record is devoid, however, that when he did return to his own home, that the decedent saw a knife that was observed by Mr. Thomas as being in the pocket but not brandished. Also undisputed is that Avi had been using meth, had charged the much lighter Chris DeVos with enough force to tackle him from inside to outside their apartment. And then finally, that the decedent had sustained only a single neck injury that 3 days later resulted in his succumbing. At trial, the prosecutor advocated for first-degree murder, and in referring to the theory of defense, pointed to what he called a gatekeeper instruction of self-defense, what he called instruction number 29, and gleaned and went on to erroneously state that the only material inquiry for the jury is whether or not the defendant was the original aggressor. The exact words the prosecution used was, "The right of self-defense is not available to the original aggressor." Now, of course, that isn't the law, but the court had given the jury 8 separate flawed jury instructions on self-defense alone. The jury confusion was inevitable. Indeed, the vast majority of the self-defense instructions were either so flawed, so misleading, so confusing, or so patently mistailored to the facts of this particular case as it applies to the law, that this court should quickly determine plain error exists. In sum, because of the grossly inaccurate instruction of law in this case, Mr. DeVos was subject to error of such plain and constitutional dimension about his theory of defense that the jury was, in essence, precluded from making a proper analysis of the facts. As a result, the integrity of the verdict cannot hold. This is especially true when the instructions are even taken as a whole. And given the other cumulative errors that exist at the time of trial, the only answer is to reverse the conviction and remand pursuant to that order. Now, unless the court wants me to address the other issues raised in the appellate brief, I would like to dedicate the majority of my argument to these erroneous instructions and the import thereof, while reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal. State v. Runyon was decided by this court in 2000. And to those trial courts that followed the directives in self-defense cases, the suggestions and the sound logic of that decision have resulted in fewer instances of confusion and the vitiation of jury findings. Unfortunately, as in the instant case, the lessons of Runyon are often both unheeded and, frankly, corrupted. Understandably, and as evident from the Runyon directives, the sample instructions offered are not a comprehensive articulation of the law that governs self-defense, or even the implication of original aggressor status should be gleaned from those sample instructions.
As to those instructions, was an objection offered at the trial?
There was no objection, Your Honor. That goes without stating. The record is devoid. And certainly, there are very few instructions, errors that are alleged that was objected to at the time of trial. To the extent that the defense felt that the exception to ineffective assistance of counsel evaluation and Strickland standards, given the background of the conflict that resulted in no fewer than 5 sealed hearings during the course of the trial necessitated by the conflict of irreconcilable differences existed. That's the background. But understandably, we are in, by this court's prior precedent, a plain error analysis. We also know that de novo, this court is to look at whether the instructions are an accurate statement of the law. Together, they were not here. Understanding also that when instruction concerns a defendant's right to self-defense, the issue does rise to constitutional magnitude. I understand that harmless error is a potential part of this analysis, and I'm prepared to address that. However, I also want to say that the many lessons from Runyon, when they are ignored in such a patent way, and instead of tailoring instructions, you're tainting instructions. And as
isn't it the obligation of counsel to at least object at that time?
One would think, Your Honor. And yet here we are.
And as to the other issue that you glossed over, that the issue of counsel. They had hearings, and in some cases, the defendant didn't give the information he was complaining that his counsel was not looking at until shortly prior to those hearings, names of witnesses and so on.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor. The record is actually full of information that needed to be provided, arguments that needed to be made. Mr. DeVos is not a lawyer or an intellectual, but he certainly knows when he's not being done right. And I think that even the most cursory review of the trial transcript after the fact sees so much glaring error that is associated with the inaction and the ineffectiveness of counsel that it turns out that he's right. But I appreciate Your Honor's position. Nonetheless, we do have a set of very flawed, at best confusing, misleading, and interfering instructions to allow that theory of self-defense to be properly considered by the jury. And as such, the integrity of the verdict as being something other than the product of unquantifiable and indeterminate origin exists before this court. And so I would beseech the court to even get past the harmless error standard and to analyze the actual instructions that were given and to just basically see how hard it would have been for the jury to consider that self-defense argument. Now, this isn't the first time that the court has had to grapple with these issues of district courts not following Runyon or the directives of Runyon. And it's getting to the point with such a bad set of instructions here, where they're essentially instructing for battery instead of murder, that they replace the word killing or some version of killing at least 12 times in four of the instructions to the prejudice of Mr. DeVos, that instead of doing what this court has directed district courts to do, they are veering so far away from protecting the rights of the defendant that it is starting to look a little bit more like structural error, and that juries are not being able to make proper determinations of self-defense because the district courts just aren't doing it right. And Mr. DeVos' case is a prime example.
Does it help us to look at discussions on the jury instructions between Mr. Jorgensen for the defendant and the prosecutor in this case? Like, did they discuss anything, at least, without saying there's an objection? Was there discussion when they settled jury instructions about the self-defense instructions? And did the word Runyon never come up?
It seems to be devoid from the interactions. Certainly, when the state offered citations, some of those do come from Runyon, although they are modified from Runyon, not in a way that tailors to the facts, but in a way that's inexplicable. Why use battery? Why constantly talk about battery when this is a murder case? Why add the superfluous defense of others when the court has consistently said you're not supposed to do that? Why not tailor these very unique and very compelling facts to a good self-defense instruction? So they didn't even use Runyon, even though the state was citing Runyon. The state was also putting forth Calchik instructions that were incomplete. This entire set of eight instructions, together or individually, was so confusing, so misleading, and the way that it was addressed by the prosecutor really gave Mr. DeVos no chance that his theory of defense was even going to be considered. It's not hard to imagine that you have the jury here looking at these instructions and say, well, the vast majority apply only to battery. Chris is responsible. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did the state argue that? Say, hey, I know that he's saying it's self-defense, but it's not because he didn't do a battery, he did a killing. I mean, did the state in this argument attempt to take advantage of this, what you're, this perceived distinction in the self-defense instructions to the detriment of Mr. Jeremias?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe they absolutely took advantage of these poorly crafted, misleading, confusing instructions because they were able to make the argument that there's a gatekeeper instruction. We all know that's not correct. That there's no further inquiry necessary if Mr. DeVos is the original aggressor and there were not sufficient instructions tailored to the facts of this case with being a question of who is the original aggressor or if original aggressor is even important under these particular facts because of the nature of how Mr. DeVos was charged when he walked in. He wasn't brandishing a weapon. He wasn't moving or advancing forward, but it's in the record that he was charged by the decedent with such force that they knocked him out and that there was no additional injury to the decedent other than that which was necessary to de-escalate the attack, especially given the fact that he was under the pain of an extremely painful injury, which either occurred prior, the 5 minute prior, if you want to call it the 5 minutes, in the house, or either occurred in the dirt or was exacerbated in the dirt. So we did have unique situations that more than any case that Runyon has probably ever anticipated, call for tailored instructions, but instead what we wound up was instructions that used the wrong word, applied to the wrong situation, had superfluous words, were incomplete, and ultimately there is strong evidence that they were not considered. May I reserve?
When he returned, didn't he say, I'm going to kill you, bro?
That there is evidence in the record from Mr. Thomas alone that through his broken jaw, those words were uttered, but no action taken on those words. In other words, no forward advancement, no brandishing of the weapon.
Knife and say, I'm going to kill you.
While he was still under the influence of a highly provocative physical injury of the painful jaw injury. So that's the context. So if that was of import, really, it should have been flowed into the voluntary manslaughter type discussion. But because these instructions were so poorly drafted, so confusing, so wrong-headed, that I don't believe that the jury even considered that. And they came up with a verdict that neither side advocated.
We have a minute and 45 seconds left.
Thank you.
Mr. Cooper.
Thank you, Thank you. May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Cooper, and I am a chief deputy district attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I represent the respondent. It appears that the argument went directly to the fifth issue in the appellate brief, so I'll focus mostly on the fifth issue in the appellate brief. I do not believe that the jury instructions were error. Obviously, as this court has already heard, there was no objection on the record as it related to the instructions, and I'll actually specifically point out that the defense attorney actually was able to get the instructions he offered in. Specifically, instruction 33, the record shows at appellate's appendix, page 1464, lines 6 through 21, there was a discussion on the record related to instruction 33, which is one of the instructions that the appellate claims was prejudicial to him. Specifically, in that section of the appendix, it states, Ms. Wong, who is the other attorney, the question was directed to her that they, she states the copy the court has in front of them is the exact copy that that the defense attorney wanted and was proposed. The court says, so the one you have, what's the difference? She states, there is no difference. I made that modification this morning. The court says, so you have, he asked for a change and you made that change. She states, correct. The court then says, okay, so we're going to give the instruction on the actual danger that the defense wants. The defense says, okay. The prosecution says, okay. It's clear from the record that specifically instruction 33 was directly asked for by the defense. Now, obviously, the state cannot go into what the defense's state of mind was as to why they asked for that specific specific instruction, or what the defense's theory of the case specifically was. But this was not a situation where, as this court sees in a lot of self-defense cases, where a killing happened instantaneously. This wasn't a situation where two people had guns, one person shoots another, and then the killing happens instantaneously at that exact moment. There was a valid causation argument in this case that the defense did actually go through if the appellate appendix is clear. Going through page 865 of the appendix, my direct examination of the doctor, in this case the coroner, as well as the cross-examination of that doctor, causation was discussed, where we were talking about what ultimately caused the death of the decedent in this case. Was it the fact that he actually was stabbed? And then we walked through the low blood pressure, the fact that he died 3 days later, the fact that the doctors actually at the hospital had sewed him up thinking that everything was okay. So then there was this issue of, did the actual stab wound cause the death? And that very well could have been a reason why the defense wanted that instruction in, specifically because it appeared from the state's vantage point that their theory of defense was that all the defendant, the appellant, was doing was attempting to save himself. He only wanted to apply enough force needed to stop his brother from attacking him again, because as the appellant said, his jaw was already broken, that his brother did have the power to cause substantial bodily harm. So it is very clear that if causation is the issue, maybe focusing on battery versus focusing on killing is a theory of the case that they wanted to be able to explore, as shown by the record. Specifically, all these instructions were accurate statements of the law, as this court was aware. And I would also point out in appellate's brief, they state that in nowhere was the jury ever instructed that a killing in self-defense was justified. That is patently incorrect. The jury instructions, specifically jury instruction 34, and specifically jury instruction 33 that was offered by the defense, jury instruction 33 says the killing is justified even if it develops after a person killed or killing was mistaken about the extent of the danger, specifically referring to a killing is justified. And instruction 34 specifically says that before the deadly blow was given. Both those instructions specifically go directly to a death is justified if acting in self-defense. So there is no confusion as to whether or not a killing in self-defense could be justified, or merely a battery in self-defense could be justified. I would also point out that this was not a situation, again, where there was only one hit or one deadly blow. It was a situation where there was, in fact, a physical altercation, as appellate does explain in their opening brief and their reply brief. There was a situation, it was referred to as a tussle by the witnesses involved. And during this tussle, the evidence came out that both men were wrestling with each other, that the defendant was hitting, the appellant was hitting the decedent during that altercation as well, and then ultimately the decedent was stabbed at the end of that altercation. The defense theory, as it appeared to the state, was that this entire fight, the batteries that occurred, as well as the actual stabbing that occurred, was all justified. So that, again, is another reason as to why the defense may have wanted battery specifically versus the word killing. Obviously, as this court's fully aware, the jury is instructed to look at the instructions taken together as a whole, which is what they did in this case, because juries are presumed to follow the court instructions. The jury instructions taken as a whole specifically lay out that a killing is justified in self-defense, as well as a battery is justified in self-defense, if you're in fact acting in self-defense. Appellate also hit on the gatekeeper instruction, as it was referred to, and as this court is fully aware, Runyon instructions do specifically state that self-defense is not available to the original aggressor. That's one of the self-defense instructions. So while it might not arguably be considered a gatekeeper, that is a correct statement of the law, that self-defense is not available to the original aggressor. That instruction was given in this case, and it was an appropriate statement of the law. Hitting further regarding the additional instructions, obviously, this court is fully aware with the Crawford decision. The Crawford decision does require the state to, or the court, to author or provide or use instructions that are tailored to the theory of the case that the defense proffers. And that specifically is what happened in this case. As I already laid out through the appellate appendix, page 1464, where it talks about the instruction 33 being given. This court, or the district court, would have been in error if they did not provide instructions that were offered by the defense that helped their theory of the case. And I think that did happen in this case as well. And then just finally, there was no confusion to the jury in this case regarding the self-defense instructions, because they do clearly line out that a killing is justified in self-defense. Speaking briefly on the issue one, that appellate counsel hit on very briefly regarding the conflict. The court did go through an analysis of the conflict. I will point out that, as this court is aware, in Moore, there was a three-pronged test related to the conflict and whether or not a conflict rises to a level that a conflict counsel or appointed counsel needs to be removed. Specifically, going through those three prongs, the extent of the conflict, going through that prong, the extent of the conflict seemed very minor in this case. The defendant at that point had an opportunity at five different occasions to raise the issues that he believed supported the withdrawal of a court-appointed attorney. The issues that he raised were, again, very minor. Specifically, he said that a witness was not found, Ms. Seabrick. However, he did not give his defense attorney the information to even find that witness. And as an aside, that witness actually ultimately was called at trial by the state. So that witness was located by the state and ultimately called, and his attorney did have the opportunity to ask her any questions that the defense wanted to be asked. His next issue was that he believed that an alibi witness was not interviewed. However, this was not a case of alibi. This was a case where in that same hearing, the defendant specifically stated that he had stabbed the victim in self-defense. So it would make no sense for the defense to proffer an alibi defense in a case of self-defense. It would be completely contradictory, and the jury would honestly probably laugh. The next issue that he said was a conflict was that he wanted to ask, as my office calls, the Matlock question, where at the close of the main witness's testimony, he wanted the question asked if he was lying on the stand. The likelihood of a question like that yielding an answer to the defendant's benefit is very, very low. The witness, Thomas, had spoke at very, very long lengths for approximately a day and a half regarding what happened that day. So to ask a question to close out a cross-examination, isn't it true you're lying about everything, doesn't appear to have any real weight, nor would it appear to yield any answer other than, no, I'm not lying, because otherwise why would the witness have stated what he stated for the past day and a half? The court's inquiry regarding the conflict was very detailed. There were five different hearings held as well, and then she actually had an opportunity to review the the inconvenience and the delay that a continuance would cause, specifically related to the fact that the court was first made aware of this issue the first day of trial. And I would also note that this was not the defendant's first attorney in this case. The record is clear that after preliminary hearing, the defendant was allowed to withdraw or allowed to fire his first court-appointed attorney, and Mr. Jurgensen ultimately was put onto the case after that. It's just a clear case where the defendant was not going to be happy with anyone's investigation, not going to be happy with anyone's presentation of evidence in this case, because he wanted to, I guess, take the reins. However, when given an opportunity to represent himself, he did decline that. I see I still do have 4 minutes left. If there are any questions, I will answer them. However, I have included my argument on those first two issues.
I think we're satisfied. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
Mr. Figler, any of the self-defense instructions standing alone, are they wrong when they're run-in? And if they are, which ones are they?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I need to just quickly address the one instruction that it was referred to that Mr. Jurgensen, as defense counsel, offered instruction 33. I beseech the court to review the record. He did not introduce, which comes from Runyon, he did not introduce it with the words battery or batterer in it. That was not a defense request. And indeed, that is fleshed out by the other instructions that use battery as well. This was clearly something that was either a mistake from the state in presenting the instructions or a mistake that came from the court, but this cannot be placed on the defense. With regard to the instructions, I'd ask Your Honor to look at number 34 as well, because the state suggested that 34 supports their position. 34 quotes 200.200. Runyon tells you, stop doing that. But if you're going to do it right. And it absolutely misstates the law. It talks about acting in self-defense, not killing another in self-defense. It again inserts this battery language instead of killing. It takes out the language of the slayer, which is very important because sometimes, and as this court knows, in talking about original aggressor, when that becomes important, that a slayer under certain in circumstances, even if they are the original aggressor, can still have self-defense. So when you look at 34, when you look at the way that the Runyon has been modified by the state, especially in instruction 29, that's where they get this gatekeeper argument. Now, it's absolutely wrong. And so when taken either individually or as a whole, I indicated that there were all those instances where they inserted battery defense when this was a murder case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Cooper, thank you for your arguments. And
Ms. Meadow stands submitted.